All right, we're live. Thank you for joining, everybody. I appreciate it. My name's Chris. I'm here with Denise Wilson, the founder and president of The Jet Agent. Denise, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
All right, so you have a pretty impressive background. So tell me what I'm missing with this too. But so, I mean, you are a jet broker right now, pilot. You founded Desert Jet, which I just learned a few minutes ago, which is awesome, on the charter and the maintenance side. So I reached out to you originally because of the bonus depreciation conversation happening about a month ago. So I definitely would like to dive into that. But also, I would like to ask you about, what do you do? Who do you serve? What are the kind of challenges that you see people dealing with? And right before we started recording, you're talking about kind of the purpose of why you started this and why you got into it. So I would like to understand, okay, how are you looking out for the buyers, the sellers of these aircraft? And yeah, what were some of the kind of negative things that you saw that led you to have this position? That's 50 questions at once. Go for it.
All right. Well, I guess how I got here. I was actually a professional pilot, airline pilot for a while, and then fortunately found business aviation right after 9/11, accidentally found business aviation. Okay. And from that experience in business aviation, I flew for flight departments and charter operators. I was a chief pilot, a director of safety, so a lot of those roles along the way. And then I started a acquisition sales company in 2007, just because I had some aircraft owners that were asking me for some help and switching their fleets around. And from that grew a management company, which was Desert Jet, based in the greater Palm Springs area. And kind of accidentally, or it wasn't planned, but some of those owners needed some revenue offset. So I started a charter operation, and that's how Desert Jet came to be. From there, okay, I started Desert Jet Maintenance 2013, and then I built a Desert Jet Center, which is the FBO there in Thermal, California.
Okay. So it started almost like, all right, you had a set of skills, you had already gone through all these different roles, and then over time, people don't manage aircraft with people they don't trust. So people trusted you enough to start managing aircraft for them. It sounds like you built up kind of a fleet of those that you were managing, Part 91. And then at a certain point, somebody might have come to you, or you might have had the idea of, hey, we could take this fleet, we can get a 135 cert, start offsetting some of the taxes and the costs, kind of built that up. And then did the 145 come from, hey, we've got to service these aircraft, let's service these, but then also, you know, we could take on outside maintenance, things like that. Is that
fair? Yeah, there was a why behind every step. So starting the charter certificate was, you know, in 2008, the people whose aircraft I was managing and who I'd acquired for them, they were all in real estate. And
good time. Yeah, good time.
Yeah, so they needed some help in offsetting some of their expenses of the operation of their aircraft, because I think it was a combination of the real estate market tanking and the big three automakers going to Congress looking for a bailout that just tanked aircraft values, like literally overnight. So
really,
it was a huge deal. I mean, if I had tried to sell their aircraft, I mean, there was one individual who I had purchased a let's say a Citation for, a light jet, and we had paid a little over $6 million for it the year prior. And when all of this hit and we went to test the market to sell it, the offers were coming in at four a year later, right after all of this went down. So all of these aircraft owners really were not in a position to sell the airplanes. So they asked for some help and, you know, what else can we do? So I came up with the idea of, well, we can put your airplane in a charter service and try to offset some of your costs, at least until all of this blows over, and then we can sell your airplane in a few years. And that's what we did.
Do you feel like having that experience? Cause that is a very, for those owners, a very much like a backs against the wall, selling and getting out of this is really not an option. I mean, unless you really want to take a bath. Do you feel like going through that experience has helped now with what you're doing? Because it's almost like an impossible scenario that you're in, that you have to find a path forward. Do you feel like things like that along the way help you now as you go to guide people on buying or selling aircraft? Like did that have an effect on? Okay.
Immensely. That starting and running the Part 145 repair station. So where, you know, I'm not an A&P myself, you know, I'm a pilot background, but I learned an awful lot about citation maintenance running and owning that maintenance company. So a lot of my clients, when we're acquiring an aircraft, we can have a deeper conversation about what the real operating costs are, not generic operating costs, but operating costs that we personalize for the serial number aircraft and based on where that aircraft is in its life cycle of maintenance, for example. And also being able to help my clients after they buy an aircraft. I was just recently engaged by a company. They did not acquire the airplane with my help or actually with anyone's help, and that was the problem. They acquired an aircraft, and let's just say they've engaged me to extract them from a huge mess with a management company that that they were working with that they're in about $1.5 million of loss due to some engine issues. And so a lot of times people will hire me to help them extract themselves from a situation that they got into when they were just, you know, unprepared for aircraft ownership.
So, and that was one of the points I wanted to talk to you about, because I think a common perception is that if you have enough money to buy an aircraft or be having that conversation, that you would automatically know inherently what the risks are and then how money could be kind of like siphoned from you and things like that. So I think that may be something that people go into this scenario with. But when you're working with people that maybe have never bought an aircraft or are kind of early in the process or are going from like a smaller to like a mid-sized business jet or something like that, if you don't mind sharing, like what are some of the things that you work with them on to ask them, okay, what are you trying to do? What's your familiarity? Also, here are these X number of factors you have to consider. This is going to lead to this cost. If you're going to operate it this way, you need to do this. Like, how do you approach that process?
Well, first I look at what their mission is going to be. And I look at what type of resources they have in terms of personnel or trusted, you know, trusted employees. So for example, if they're coming from a smaller jet and moving into a larger one, do they already have a management company? Do they have a trusted pilot or flight department manager that they've been working with? And that frankly makes the situation a lot easier. But more often than not, we don't have that situation. And so finding someone that can manage the aircraft for them after the purchase is a huge part of the process, because you don't know what you don't know as a brand new aircraft owner. And there are so many areas within aircraft ownership that can trip up the budget that's been planned. And speaking of the budget, obviously we do a mission analysis, a full operating cost analysis, but also a projection of what we think the aircraft's going to be worth at the exit. And again, we personalize the operating costs for that particular airplane. So it's my job to make sure that nobody is surprised when they're operating the aircraft, because I have been brought in many times to sell an airplane where I hear the stories about, well, you know, we bought this airplane, we were given this report that said it was going to cost XYZ to operate it, and it was, you know, X percentage, you know, some pretty big numbers larger than what they were told it would be. And that just ruins a first-time jet buyer's experience and sours them on business aviation. So it's really important to me that anyone that I work with is really well-informed going in.
Okay. And with the background of running Desert Jet and the 145 side, what are some of the things that you get into at the onset when looking at the maintenance records, whether it's like historical logbook entries or the maintenance projections, or maybe they have a certain type of engine that can be overhauled at this amount versus replacement? Like what are some of the levers that you pull on when you're doing that research and then also like giving that recommendation to the customers?
Yeah, I dive pretty deep on the background on aircraft before we go making offers on airplanes. So, you know, we pull the 337s from the FAA just to cross check what we're being told. Obviously, I get camp access, Traxel, whatever access, so I can look through the records remotely before we, you know, even proceed. I did have one, unfortunately, this only happened one time, but this has stayed with me my entire career. One time about actually 20 years ago, where I went to inspect a Citation Excel, and I had gone through the logbooks already and looked at the aircraft, and I ended up discovering that there were logbook entries that had been removed from the airplane having to do with the corrosion repair. And I mean, like a legit attempt at fraud, and to cover that up. So, you know, I cross-check all inspections. So if I have a SESCOM 10 report that tells me phase 1 through 5 or a DOC 10 or 22 or what have you, depending on the aircraft, was done in a certain period, I go back and I cross-reference everything and I look for all those records to make sure that I really understand what the condition of the aircraft is. Unfortunately, that has only happened one time, but if it happens once, I'm concerned it'll happen again.
Yeah. I mean, you gotta look out for it for sure. So when you're going through that process, you're almost going back through the history and then you're looking for gaps in that, you know, as one part of this, I guess.
Correct. Because, you know, there's a lot of things I'm not going to be able to tell until I get into a pre-buy inspection, right? I mean,
yep.
You know, mismatched paint with no logbook entries that connect it. Okay, well, there's my smoking gun. But I try to find out as much as I can before we're expending my client's money on a pre-buy inspection.
Got it. Yeah, it's you've got like a whole investigator aspect of
this. Yes, I do.
I mean, being a business owner, I'm sure helped with that, because that's what running a business is half the time, is that doesn't really make sense. Can you tell me more about this?
Seek to understand. Yeah, that's been a key phrase for me for, I guess, a couple decades at this point.
Yep. And so when you're going through this process, or I guess if I could back up a little bit, maybe it's more philosophical or your overall approach, but what are some of the things that you typically see newer or even experienced buyers get kind of taken advantage of through the process of buying or selling an aircraft? Because I know when we talked before, you mentioned like there's kind of people in the middle that if you don't have a trusted relationship or it's not, you know, equitable, money can be taken out of the mix. So what are the common ways that people can get take advantage of that they don't even realize could happen?
Yeah, middle, I'm going to call them middlemen. I'm not going to call them brokers, because brokers, for the vast majority of brokers, especially the ones that I work with, are professionals that are trying to do exactly the same thing I'm doing, which is protecting their clients. But there are a lot of people out there that I'm going to get in trouble on LinkedIn for this, but here we go. Wannabe brokers, people that want to become a broker, but they have absolutely no aviation experience at all, no aircraft knowledge, anything. All they're in this for is to make money. And what I see, and I've seen this, and I still see it today, and it's so frustrating, buyers don't understand that if they forego hiring an acquisition representative, they're at risk of being in the middle of a deal where somebody in the middle is making a bunch of money, but they're not getting the benefit of the representation for that. So
okay.
Maybe they don't know that acquisition representation is a thing. But other times it's that they think they want to save the money, and that, you know, they're very smart people. A lot of entrepreneurs, business owners, people that sold their businesses, what have you, that are buying aircraft, they're very smart people. They've run multiple companies. I almost can understand that thought process, right? That, hey, I'm smart enough. This is just buying an airplane. I can buy a car. I bought my yacht. I bought my house. That they can do this on their own. But what they don't realize is that our industry doesn't have the same protections that some of the other industries that we're talking about have. And the small amount they could be saving in a commission having someone with fiduciary duty looking out for them, they might be at risk at losing even more money because if somebody's inserted themselves in the middle as a middleman and is making, you know, $500,000 on the middle of a deal.
So what would be like, what would be a real world scenario of where that happens? Because it's easy, you know, and this is not a knock on you or brokers, but it's easy from the broker's perspective to say, hey, spend the money with me. I'm actually going to make this process the way it's supposed to be, and you'll get the end result you're looking for. It will cost you X dollars, but it's not going to cost you 3X. So like, I get that part of doing it the right way. What would be an example of where that middleman is taking advantage of somebody and it ends up being probably like the scenario you mentioned before? You're $1.5 million in the hole and you really don't know how you got there. But like, what are the ways that that kind of happens?
So let's say that that word gets out that you're looking to buy an aircraft. And what I mean by that is you're a buyer. You've reached out to on a couple of listings on Controller. And you've spoken to some brokers about airplanes that are listed for sale. And you maybe talked to the wrong person. And that person knows that you're a buyer, but maybe the airplane that you called on is no longer available. Or maybe it was a phantom listing. Maybe it wasn't even really an aircraft for sale in the first place. Then that person goes and looks for an airplane. But because they don't have the contacts, they don't have the network, they're going to another broker that has an airplane that's listed, or maybe that's an off-market, a pocket listing, we call it. And then that person in the middle tries to put the deal together between the broker and the buyer. And, you know, there's who knows what the number is that's in the middle, that person in the middle is making. Now, if you have an acquisition consultant, that person will know what it is and can tell the buyer, okay, here are all the people in the chain that's making money on this. And the buyer may feel like, okay, great. There's transparency. I know at least what it is and I know what I'm getting. Okay. I understand that. And I'm willing to do this. Or they say, no, I'm not comfortable with this. Let's move on to another airplane. The transparency is important.
Sure.
So that the buyer knows exactly what they're getting. And if you have somebody in the middle there, I think this is the key part for me. If you have somebody in the middle there making a commission, but that person isn't representing you in a way that they're giving you fiduciary duty, what are you paying for? You're paying for finding the airplane, but you're still on your own in terms of representation and making sure that the airplane is as represented and that the legal agreements are in your favor. And that you're protected along the way.
I see. Okay. So it's more so in that way, technically you're in that middleman position, just like this other person would be. But what's happening in that scenario that you've seen is that person might not have the experience, the background, might not view it as, hey, I am truly a representative of this person buying, selling the aircraft, whatever the transaction might be. And so they're not going to be able to give them the correct advice, or at least the most educated ability to make the most educated decision. And so because of the nature of aircraft and how much things cost and the complexity of what hides in the logbooks, and when you find that after you've owned the aircraft for a year and you find out, okay, I actually have an $800,000 bill instead of $300,000 this year. Like, is that what you mean by having the right representation and like where those things can fall off the rails?
That's one. Those are a few of the very many more. I mean, we could probably have a 2-hour conversation about all the different ways. I think that someone can be harmed by purchasing a jet without having somebody on their side representing their best interests.
Yep. Yeah. And it's funny you said yacht in that, because I was in the aircraft maintenance tracking world before left, and I did yacht maintenance tracking for about 2 years, something like that. And then came back to aviation. And it's very similar in that world. It's people that have a lot of money, pretty smart, you know, doers, business owners, all that stuff. And it's just, I don't think people explain to them how much that this boat is going to cost them. You bought a boat for, you know, $5 million, but nobody told them that the cost of ownership is 20% of that every single year. You're going to be paying $1 million every single year for insurance, for maintenance, for all these things. And nobody really tells them. And then also nobody tells them how to be proactive moving forward, right? Like, you need a captain, you need somebody who's going to maintain this thing, because if you can proactively do this, your maintenance bills will be $100,000 versus everything breaks and it's $600,000. So I thought that was interesting too, that you go through the process of asking them about the pilot, about the management company, not just buy this and it's going to be a great airplane and everything's awesome, but like, hey, you're going to buy this and that's the beginning of this whole process. You need somebody who's going to actually, I can help you get it. You need somebody who's going to help you actually go and run with this.
It is quite a journey. It is quite a journey. I think anyone that's on their second aircraft, you know, looks back at the first time they bought a jet, and I think probably appreciates a little bit more what it takes to be an aircraft owner. It's not as passive as a process as you might think, especially if you have a management company and a pilot you trust. There's still oversight that needs to occur.
Yeah, some serious checks and balances still. <Yeah. laughs> All right, so I guess if we can shift over to the bonus depreciation, and then happy to come back to whatever you want to touch on. But I know, all right, so bonus depreciation, very hot topic right now, at least in terms of LinkedIn posts and volume of them. But yeah, if we can, what is bonus depreciation? And then why should people consider it? How do you navigate them through the process? What is that like?
Well, first of all, do you need an aircraft? I have seen people over the years purchase aircraft just because they needed a tax write-off. And in the case when, 2017? And like, I guess 2017 to 2001-ish, when we were able to take 100% bonus depreciation, right? And then we, I think maybe even 2022. And then we did a step down of, 80%, then 60%, every year there was a step down process there of how much you could take in the first year. It's basically a tax write-off that you can take off of your business income. So there's an assumption here that you're using the airplane for business, and that you have enough income that you can offset the deduction. Now, what I was touching on was that there, we saw over the last, like, it was this 8 years now or so, where people sometimes have been buying aircraft just to take advantage of the tax deduction, with the thought being, well, I'd rather put the money into an airplane than give the money to the IRS. But some of those things we talked about, the operating costs, aren't always taken into consideration. And it's quite a test to make sure that you meet the requirements, the business use requirements, to be able to fully benefit from that deduction. So I always say, don't buy the jet just because you need the deduction. Buy the jet because the jet is going to make your life better. It's going to give you time back. It's going to make your time with, the little time that we all have on this planet, it's going to make it more, it's going to multiply, basically, right? You can do more with less time when you're not waiting for a commercial flight and connecting through hubs and all of that. Not to mention the privacy that you have and being able to fly closer to the destination, right? All of us on this podcast know the benefits of business aviation, so I won't get into that. But the key points on business aviation, on using the bonus depreciation, is that if you're looking to buy an aircraft and you want to take advantage of bonus depreciation this year, it's as we're recording this podcast, we're at the end of August, and we're already seeing that demand has picked up quite a bit over the last, I guess it's only been a month and a half since this bonus depreciation officially came back. But you have to get started right away. And the key parts are you purchase an aircraft, use it primarily for business, and you need to take delivery and put the aircraft into operation by December 31st. Now, there are a lot
of this year or of the same year?
Of this year. Now, what's great about this new version of bonus depreciation that was approved this year is that there's not a step down, at least right now, there's not a step down in the percentage that you can take in future years. So if you decide to buy an airplane in January, you can still take the 100% bonus depreciation. Now, there's a bunch of things to discuss about, you know, how much business use exposure do you have if you're purchasing in, you know, December 1st of this year and your test period is December 1st to December 31st versus you buy in January and you have a whole year ahead of you. Some of those issues that we had in the past have been addressed with this new version. There's a lot of nuance. And so I always tell my clients, what we need to do is bring in a tax expert to go through your specific scenario and to see if the record keeping and the benefits and your business usage, if it makes sense for you to pursue this deduction.
Do you look at that from more of an initial qualification phase or point of view, or do you look at that from initial qualifications plus cost of ownership plus using it for the next X number of years? Like where does that accounting person come into play in this scenario?
An aviation tax expert on every acquisition should be consulted, because there are other things that we consider, like, which state will you be taking delivery in? Are there other ways to structure your ownership of the airplane so that you're not paying, for example, state sales and use tax all in one lump? So I always recommend that whether or not a person is planning to use, you know, maybe you have someone, and I have a lot of these clients who no longer have business use because they've exited their businesses, they're retired now. So bonus depreciation isn't a thing for them. But even in those cases, I still recommend that we bring in a tax person to help set up the structure for other taxes, namely, you know, state sales tax is easy to handle, but use tax is usually slides in as an identical tax. And so deciding where we're taking delivery of an aircraft and where the airplane is going to be based and utilized is important to talk to a tax expert to get that structure set up right from the beginning.
Okay. And then and I know you mentioned a few other roles that you bring in during this process. What other roles do you bring in?
So legal, usually, especially for more complicated deals, especially for international clients, if we're using ownership trusts and things of that nature. So bringing in legal representation for our clients is an important part. And we have several people that we work with on a regular basis. And I'm looking forward to meeting others as well. I know we have a lot of legal professionals in our industry that I'm still meeting for the first time today. So bringing someone in that capacity is important. If there's financing involved, I always connect my clients to finance folks that I've worked with in the past that have been successful for previous clients. Insurance brokers, especially because I personally deal with a lot of buyers who are also pilots themselves and many times single pilot operators. So bringing in insurance and training partners early is something I do a lot of. Let's see, we covered insurance and then management companies. And the rare case, honestly, I don't do this very often, but occasionally I have someone that wants to put an aircraft into a charter situation after the acquisition. But usually they just need management or they need need my assistance in vetting a pilot that they might hire.
How long is this process to go through this assessment that you do from your side and then bring in these other experts and kind of meet with the client and steer them in the right direction? What's the time frame for that? What's kind of the level of effort that goes into that?
Well, when we first start an acquisition, it's a full-time process for me the first week. I move quickly on pre-due diligence, right? The due diligence is what the pre-buy facility does, but I'd like to do a lot of pre-due diligence. And so that first week is mission analysis, operating costs, determining what the insurance and training requirements are going to look like for either the owner or whoever the flight crew is going to be, determining what the needs, if there is any needs for financing, and frankly, most of my clients pay cash, but occasionally we do have folks that are looking at financing. And then the tax piece. And we always try to start the tax piece early so that when we're doing the financial projections, we know exactly what kind of numbers to put in for, ongoing, maybe it's use tax, the structure, if it's a lease, for example, an internal lease, but we're putting the lease payments into the projections as well as the benefits of the tax benefits potentially from bonus depreciation, Section 179 expensing, or what have you.
And is this available on new and used aircraft?
Yes. Yes. Back, I don't know, a decade or longer ago, there was a period of time where bonus depreciation only applied to new aircraft. But no, that hasn't been the case in the last couple presidential administrations, let's call it.
Got it. I had a question that was just top of mind. Oh, okay. So the market with what's happening with this right now, what are some trends? I guess the obvious questions are, who are the kinds of people buying aircraft and taking advantage of this? And then are there any things that you're seeing happening in the market now that maybe a lot of people don't recognize, or it's like an early indicator or something? Yeah. Or something that's happening that you didn't expect from this, but you're noticing that trend?
Yes. So I'll give a little bit of background first. Back in, let's say summer of 2020, from summer of 2020 on to about 2023, we had a very frantic pace of aircraft sales. 2023, things started cooling. The beginning of this year for our company was definitely cooler this year. So with all the talk of bonus depreciation, we were expecting that things would get a little busier at the end of the year as we ran into the end of the year. But I'll be honest, I underestimated how busy that would be. I mean,
really?
I'm at the point to where I'm doing a lot of the same type of deals I was doing during the pandemic, which is all off-market airplanes, meaning, I have a Challenger 300 listing and I put it under contract before even listing. It never even hit any of the online sites. Same thing with two other Citation M2s. It never hit the market, so to speak, because I had contacts that I knew were looking for airplanes, or they heard that I was going to be bringing it to market and the plane sold, which I think is another tick there for hiring an acquisition consultant, because that's how you access the world of brokers who have these airplanes. And all three of these airplanes that I just mentioned, fantastic options, and literally just sold through network.
Yeah. And I mean, if you've been doing it for this long and you have those relationships with people who have been doing it for that long, there is an inherent trust, obviously trust, but verify, but there's an inherent trust that I am going to be looking at something that's decent quality or above, likely this person that you've had a relationship with for X number of years. It's probably not going to hide that corrosion logbook entry from you. So it's a better starting point. Plus, I imagine with this happening, if the volume's faster than you'd imagine, then the time frame that something is available has to be, that window's got to be pretty small when like a good quality aircraft is available.
Yeah, I have a few acquisitions right now where unfortunately I'm on the other side of that. I have one acquisition, let's say it's for an aircraft that there are none on the market. So I'm looking for them off market, and I've uncovered two off market. And, you know, I'm feeling the same pressure to move, you know, to move quickly for my client that I did back in, you know, the post-pandemic days. Over the last couple of years, we could be a little bit more relaxed and maybe play a little bit more aloof on certain airplanes. And this isn't in all markets. I should clarify this a little bit. So airplanes that are newer, still in production, definitely are in much more demand than airplanes, let's call them legacy aircraft. You know, higher time airplanes with damage history, corrosion history, that were built to the 90s or at this point, even the early 2000s, you know, legacy, we're calling that now. Those airplanes are lingering a bit longer. But if it's a great pedigree airplane, nice low time, newer aircraft, they're moving quickly.
Okay. And how do you balance that speed with kind of your philosophy of making sure that the customer is getting the best, you know, aircraft, right? Because, you know, that's some pretty high pressure to move and make a decision and buy a multi-million dollar aircraft, but you also have this extra level of due diligence. Like, how do you balance that?
I'm lucky. I have a really great team behind me, so I don't have to do everything myself. You know, I'm looking at my travel schedule here over the next 6 weeks and the, you know, closings and pre-buys and visual inspections and what have you that I have. And I'm already delegating some of that to some of like my maintenance tech person at the company, our other sales directors. So all of us as a team, we pull together on deals and make sure that everything is done right. And a lot of times, you know, I can tie up an airplane with an LOI until I've had a chance to do a little bit more pre-due diligence. And if I see something I don't like before a purchase agreement, no, we can pivot.
Yep. Got it. Okay. And so one of the things I wanted to ask you before we wrapped up was, so you had this whole progression from pilot, management, charter, 145, selling that. And then why did you get into doing this?
You know, I was literally running three businesses at a time, plus doing from the ground up construction of a brand new FBO, all at the same time, and trying to fly a full-time flight schedule. I was a little, let's just say I was a little overextended. and it was actually the death of my father led me to just kind of step back for a minute and think about what am I doing with my life? And I took a long, hard look at my day-to-day at Desert Jet and thought about, you know, over these last 14 years, what have I enjoyed and what have I not enjoyed? And I came to the conclusion that what I really loved the most was, you know, those times where I'd be flying one of my customers and they'd come up to the cockpit and say, oh, I really love this airplane. What would it take to buy one of these? And the conversations we'd have where I'd learn about their business and I'd learn about their family. And really got some really great relationships with the aircraft owners. And so as I thought about that, it was like, you know, what I really love doing is helping people use business aviation to make their lives, their businesses better. And so I decided what I wanted to do was full-time acquisitions and sales and not do all the other stuff. Unfortunately, I could not do that at Desert Jet because that business just drained all of my time in other areas. And so I made the decision to sell it and I got into back into full-time acquisitions and sales. And I focus primarily on acquisitions because I've seen people get burnt buying aircraft without representation. I see the back end of a deal and I can see everything that's happening. And because we don't have any licensing or regulation in this industry having to do with brokers and aircraft sales, I don't know. I just felt like I had a calling or a bigger purpose to help protect buyers. And so you know, I wanted to do something where I felt like I had a purpose, where everything that I'd learned up to this time in aviation could be put to good use. And that's what it was. And it's been so rewarding, so much more rewarding doing this than what I did at Desert Jet. I think I made the right choice.
Nice. What was that? I guess from the time that you made that decision to when you sold the company, what was that time difference?
You know, it was a year. It wasn't a year. It was about 4 months. And I had my business coach at the time said, you know what, Denise, you've just gone through, you know, this death in your family. This is not the time for you to just go upend your entire life. So what I did was I put a new CEO in place at Desert Jet, and I took 1 year off. And I told myself, okay, I'm going to go do this acquisition and sales. I went to work for Jet Aviva. I said, I'm going to do this for 1 year, and then I'm going to make a decision about whether to sell or not. And when that 1 year was up, I already knew before the 1 year. But when the 1 year was up, I sold the business.
Okay. It took you 4 months to figure it out, and you're like, all right, I know what I'm doing in 8 months, pretty much.
Yes.
Okay. That's cool. Yeah. It's weird that sometimes those massive life events, like losing a parent, it's the thing that ends up making you take a step back and actually like reevaluate and even evaluate, what do I like about this? What are the things that I don't? Okay, how do I find an off ramp, an exit ramp for this?
Yeah.
You know, and it's interesting you say that too. I kind of learned this over, I did a business podcast down here in Southwest Florida. So I talked to a bunch of business owners. And then now that working with Ebis, I'm talking with the owners of maintenance repair shops and all of this kind of stuff. And I don't think everybody thinks too far ahead about how they're going to exit their business and what people will value it at. And I've seen a lot of people overestimate that this is the retirement plan. Like, I'll get a 5X for my company kind of thing, but they don't put the things in place to be able to show those financials, show the costs, the revenues, the percentages. I guess, I know this is completely off topic, but what were some of the things that you did in preparation for selling the company to make it more marketable, to get a higher value for it? If you don't mind me asking.
No, sure. Well, I hired a business coach. So with Desert Jet grew very, very quickly. I mean, to the point to where very early in the company's beginning, we were on the Inc. 500, 5,000 list like 5 years in a row. And, you know, for me, you know, my background was, I was an oboe player that became a pilot, right? So I didn't go to business school or any of those things. So I realized that I had to kick it in gear and start learning how to not only run a business, but how to scale a business. Because if I was doing everything myself, the business was worth nothing. I was worth something, but the business would be worth nothing. So I had to, and I did create a lot of processes so that the company could run without me. And so that was a huge part. And frankly, that's why I built the FBO. FBOs sell for a much larger multiple of EBITDA than a charter operation. You know, I'd say in order of, it would be the FBO, then the maintenance company, and then the charter operation. So, I knew that, you know, the FBO was my key in my mind to, I guess, building a little empire that where I could do an exit. Now, Destin Cordier has a seminar coming up, I think, in the next month or two, called Boss, where it addresses exactly these questions for business owners and how you can build a business, not just build a lifestyle business, for example, but build a business that's worth something without you, is something you can exit. And I'm really excited that Destin Cordier is doing this, and excited to see, you know, what everyone's thoughts are about that seminar. But the business coach was, I'd say, the biggest part for me. I hired a business coach who was not in aviation, who had dealt with a lot of entrepreneurs who had done exits, And he really changed my thinking on a lot of things about how to grow the business for an exit.
Okay. That's cool. Yeah. It's, and that's typically where I see people tend to do a better job on the exit and kind of setting it up that way is if you bring somebody in who can take a look at your books, how you have things structured, how much relies on you versus how much you've kind of built processes around it. Yeah. And I don't, one of the things, I guess I learned this from my parents, but they're like, whatever you do in work, try to replace your own job where like you can be replaced. Yes. And make it that way and then go figure out the next set of challenges, kind of get that reined in and then make yourself replaceable again and again. And I think a lot of times I see people do the opposite.
Yes.
But it does kind of handcuffs you to wherever you're at in a way. Does that make sense?
It does. In fact, I think one of the very first business books I read was The E-Myth Revisited. It's probably a 20 year old book at this point, but it goes through exactly that thought process and how to, you know, when you're building a business, you should be designing processes that anyone that you hire can do. Now the processes are unique because from your own viewpoint of how you see the world or the process or the business, you know, the way you create that process has your own stamp on it. But as a business founder or owner, if you're doing all of those processes yourself, you don't have a business. You have a job.
Yep. Yeah. It's the working in the business versus on the business. But, you know, I do see a difference in people that have worked in their business and then on it. There is a deeper understanding of kind of what's happening and where the levers actually are that you can pull. Like I'm working with one customer that we're onboarding now, and they're expanding to beyond one shop. They're expanding to three. And it's like the guy that runs it is not a mechanic as far as I know, but he's in the thick of the business and running it. And his approach is like, do the processes so you understand what technicians are doing, what DOMs are doing, what the finance team is doing. So you have this core understanding of what's happening, what the processes are, and then you could hand it off to somebody to run with, to improve it, that you can kind of sustain it and maintain it. But I do see a big difference between people that have that ground level experience and then move into managing it versus when people don't have that ground level or aren't really interested in getting to that ground level. I don't know, just different caliber is what I've noticed.
You know, yes. What I mean? I've seen that. Yeah. You know, I'm thankful today that I did every role that I did at Desert Jet, you know, from, you know, I booked charter trips. I built the website. I did, you know, the very first year, right? I'm doing QuickBooks. I'm flying the trips, coming home at night, booking the charters, and then going into QuickBooks, doing all of those things. I wrote every manual there was at the company. I did the 145 certification. I did the 135 certification. And the FBO, I mean, I had to become an expert at lobbying politically, which I wasn't expecting, and construction methods. You know, yeah, I'm really thankful looking back that I had all those things, but all that experience. But yeah, what you're talking about, you know, I've seen people come and buy a company and think that because the person they bought the company from built a successful business, that they thought it was just going to continue to be successful, but they didn't know how the business ran, for example. They didn't have aviation experience, or maybe they were a VC firm or PE firm or a person with a lot of money, whatever that is. And yeah, you can definitely tell the difference.
And I think the canary in the coal mine is who they view as their customer, right? Like when your customer is no longer the customer and it's somebody else, maybe like a board or whatever it might be, when the focus shifts away from taking care of the customer, I think that's kind of like the most obvious first fracture that you kind of see take place. But
agreed. I don't know.
This might be another one of those topics we could talk for 2 hours about. But well, Denise, thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it. It was nice to meet you. And before we wrap up, is there anything else that you want to touch on?
No, I thank you for having me on your show. You know, when we started Desert Jet Maintenance, we used EBIS. And yep. So it was great to, you know, to connect on the podcast with you today.
Yeah, cool. And just so you know, I know you're not in the maintenance world anymore on that side, but we did put out a new version. So it's cloud-based. Okay. It's not the server-based anymore. We made some updates, but no, it was thank you for walking us through this. I really appreciate it.
Nice chatting with you, Chris.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody.